Hello, 13thers. Brandy Churchwell here with the latest update on the trial of Thomas Randolph. We made it all the way to day 5 of trial, so if you missed the first few episodes, make sure you go back and listen. Day 5 starts off with a bang when we find out that there was some juror drama. We aren't allowed to listen to everything, but we hear that there are apparently a couple of jurors who came in this morning and they said that a security guard or somebody dressed like a security guard yelled out to them that if someone is a politician, that they should vote not guilty. So they plan on bringing the jurors in and asking them about this and asking them if they heard anything else about the case. There are also some issues that defense brings up before the jury comes in. Today, there are family members of Mike Miller that are going to be testifying, and defense wants to make sure that they don't bring up speculation about teasing Mike Miller about being more than friends with Tom. Apparently, his aunt and uncle made some comments kind of teasing him and asking him if he and Tom are in a relationship now. Now, to be clear, nobody believes that there's any kind of romantic relationship going on between them. The teasing is basically kind of a reflection of the strangeness of the level of contact that Mike and Tom had. The state said that it's not damaging and it's not derogatory toward homosexuality. It's just a reflection of how much they talk. That communication isn't normal between a handyman and a guy paying him, for example, but it is normal in a relationship. The judge says that they can comment on the level of communication and if they thought it was strange or not, but they are not able to speculate about their relationship. Now there's another issue from the defense. Clifton Miller is scheduled to testify today. He has said that Mike made a statement about a plot to kill Sharon for Tom, so defense said that that's not admissible. They don't want that to come in because of furtherance of conspiracy, and they said the court shouldn't allow it. Now, the state said that they aren't bringing that in anyway, so it doesn't really matter, but they are going to tell the jury that Clifton said that he had told Mike repeatedly to get out of that friendship or whatever they had going on because he said it's trouble. The state said that they are also going to ask Clifton, which is Mike's cousin, about how he advised him not to house sit for Tom and told him to leave Tom alone. He's going to get shot. And that Mike told him that he is going to be coming into money. Now, there's also some back and forth about some testimony that will be coming in from Billy, who is Mike's uncle. Billy said that Mike told him he was going to be working as a driver for Tom and that he was going to be coming in to $400,000. Now, defense doesn't want this coming in. Shocker. They said that it's not admissible as furthering conspiracy. The state says that's not even why we're bringing it in. We're bringing it in under the state of mind and future plans, and that this statement came in from the last trial anyway, so they can bring it in regardless. He had apparently talked about future plans with his uncle, and he said that his girlfriend from Florida that he had broken up with, that he had a baby with, I guess they were going to get back together, but he said that he kind of thought it was weird because he wasn't working at the time, so he didn't really know how Mike was going to be getting back with her. So his uncle said that they gave him work, and he kept saying that he's going to leave and everything will be fine. Mike told his uncle Billy that he was going to be coming in to about $400,000 and he and Tom were going to go buy jet skis. Now, defense does not want them to say the amount that he was coming into. He said that it looks like furthering the conspiracy. There's some back and forth, and the judge actually gets a little bit frustrated because as they're arguing, there's a little bit of interruption and talking over her. And y'all, I love this judge. She is sassy and she does not take any crap from anybody. And if anybody talks over her, she is quick to tell them this is her court. Nobody talks when she's talking. I love it. So after all that gets worked out, our first on the stand is Clifton Miller. This is Mike Miller's cousin. Clifton said that his cousin Mike came to Las Vegas to live in December of 2007. At the time, Clifton was working detailing cars, and he brought Mike in to help him work. He said that Mike didn't really know what he was doing, but Clifton taught him how to do everything, and he said that he was a good worker. It wasn't long before he came to find out that Tom had entered the picture and that his cousin was doing handyman work for him. Now, when the prosecutor asked Clifton if his cousin Mike Miller was good at the handyman type stuff, he said, no, absolutely not. He wasn't good at things like that at all. I guess he was actually kind of surprised that he had a handyman job. Mike had apparently told Clifton about his plan to house sit for Tom. Clifton said that he told him that is a bad idea. Do not do that. He said that he even warned Mike he's going to end up getting shot and he needs to stop hanging out with Tom. He said it's bad news. He said he actually pulled away and stopped spending as much time with Mike because of his relationship with Tom. About a month before Mike's death, Clifton said that he actually started pulling away and not hanging out with him because his kid's mother, his girlfriend at the time, was really uncomfortable with him hanging out with Mike because of Mike and Tom's relationship. The last conversation that he remembers having with his cousin on the phone, he said that he talked to Mike and Mike said that he's still hanging out with Tom, and I guess they were actually out at that moment at a shooting range. He said that he was disappointed that he was still hanging out with him and they didn't have a great conversation about it, and he said he actually hung up on him. Now, Clifton never met Tom or Sharon in person. He did say that he does know that Mike had talked to him before about Tom having a lot of guns in a safe, but he had never actually been over there and had never met Tom. Clifton's testimony was short and sweet, and we move on to the next. Now, I'm actually going to skip around a little bit because we have a couple of DNA analysts that come up next, but since Clifton started the testimony of the day, I want to kind of stick with Mike Miller's family and tell you what happened with all of them together to kind of give you a better picture without splicing it up like they did in court. The next family member up on the stand is Vita Miller. Now, they ask Vita's relationship to Mike, and she said that that is his auntie by marriage. Mike came to live there in Christmas, right around Christmas Eve, actually, of 2007, and she said that her and her husband did commercial office cleaning. They owned a business doing that, and they brought Mike along with them sometimes to work. She said she met Tom before, and it was actually at her home. Tom had come there, and Mike introduced them. They asked, did you see Mike interact with him? And she said that they stayed at the mailbox in the car talking for hours in Tom's car. She said that she actually even went up and offered them food because they were out there for so long. She said that Mike came in and got some food or some chips and then went back out and got back in the car and kept talking to Tom. She said that Mike used to have a cell phone, but his cell phone wasn't working anymore after a while, so she would get calls at home for Mike from Tom. She said that Tom left messages for Mike on their landline, and she said many, many, many times. When trying to get her to estimate, she said that it's probably around 200. Now, keep in mind, 200 calls, and they only knew each other for a few months. She said that she thought that the relationship between Mike and Tom was odd. And she said that she offered to have Mike listen to those messages from Tom, and he said that he didn't even want to hear them. He never even cared to listen to them. Vita also said that there was one message that Tom left saying that Mike needed to bring back his gun. He needed to bring his gun home as soon as possible. She said that Mike never actually listened to or heard that message. She said that Mike did tell her that he was going to be moving away with a girl and that he was going to be coming into some money. After Mike's death, the first time that Vita talked to detectives was early in the morning on May 9th. So this is right after the murders. She gave a voluntary statement to Detective Mogg, and her husband Billy was also present. They answered questions together in that interview sitting at the kitchen table. During that interview that morning, apparently, Billy and Vita had talked to detectives about a ski mask they had. She said in that moment that she had the ski mask at some point, but she doesn't remember seeing it since before Christmas. Now, defense has taken this statement that she made 15 years ago about that mask, and they have said over and over that she said that she hasn't seen it since December of 2007 when her nephew, Mike Miller, moved in. Y'all, that is not what she said. What she said was she had a mask, or they had a mask, and she has not seen it since probably before Christmas. Now, probably before Christmas is a whole lot different than December when Mike moved in. She told the detectives at the time that she cleans the areas where she thinks it would normally be, but she hasn't seen it. At the end of that interview, she let them search the house for the mask, and they didn't find it anywhere. When they asked her what the mask looked like, she said she doesn't remember. They asked if she ever let her nephew use her car or her bike. She had said in a previous statement that she would let him use the bike sometimes or borrow the car if he was looking for a job. They asked, "Do you recall, under oath, saying that Tom had been at the house on two different occasions?" Now, the reason they're asking her this is because there was some discrepancy about whether he had been there two times or three times or whatever. But she said that she does remember seeing Tom and Mike sitting together at the mailbox. She said maybe three times. They also asked Vita if she remembers talking about missing a pair of gloves. She said that she kind of remembers something about gloves, but she's not really sure. Keep in mind, this has been 15 years ago. Also, she said that she does remember that Mike said he's going to be coming into some money, moving to Florida or California, and will not have anything to do with Tom anymore. Vita also said that she remembers a conversation about a week before the murders, and she said that Mike was upset because Tom had made some comments to him about how, "I don't know how you can afford a girlfriend, but you can't afford cigarettes," or something like that. She said that after that, Mike told her that he wasn't going to have anything else to do with Tom. After Auntie Vita left, up next is Uncle Billy Miller. Now, y'all, I love me some Uncle Billy Miller, too. He was just as sharp as he could be and just seemed like a good guy. Hard worker, honest. This seems like a really great family. Billy said that he has met Tom before. He said that Mike and Tom were actually at the house before, and Tom waved him over, and he introduced himself. Now, he said that Tom had been in their garage before. Their daughter was actually visiting and said Tom wants to see his cars. He said he thought that was weird because he was very private with his cars, and Mike wasn't really into them anyway. He said he saw Tom in front of the mailboxes in the car, just like Auntie Vita had said, and he said that he saw them talking, and it was often with the windows up. Now, he said that they would stay in the car for hours, and they weren't working on anything. They were sitting in there talking for hours. Billy also said the same thing about Mike being able to use the car when he was looking for a job, but he said that he would often just pick him up from the bus stop. He said he also remembers Tom picking Mike up several times a week. Picking him up, dropping him off, that type of thing. Uncle Billy also remembers the crazy amount of messages that came on their answering machine from Tom. He said that he actually deleted a lot of those messages because their system was just getting overloaded. He said that Tom seemed elderly compared to Mike, so he thought that their friendship was kind of weird. And he said that he thought that Tom was originally just going to help Mike get part-time handyman work. But then Mike said that Tom liked him and he was trying to help him get work, so he said he just really didn't want to look too much into it. Eventually, he said Mike complained that he wasn't getting enough work from Tom, but they continued to hang out. He said that there were often times where Tom wasn't able to do the jobs and he didn't feel good and he would kind of put everything off. And Mike was supposed to be helping him and working for him, but Tom couldn't do it because of his back or whatever other reason. So he said that he would end up having to go over there and then he would come back with no money and be upset. Now, when they asked Uncle Billy about guns and if Mike had any of the guns or anything that he had to do with Tom's guns, he said something that really stood out to me.
Did he tell you whether or not Tom gave him the gun or anything about that?
He said Tom wanted him to get familiar with the gun.
Okay.
I know he's soft-spoken, but did you catch that? Mike said that Tom gave him the gun to hold because he wanted him to get familiar with how to use his gun. I thought that was odd. Mike told his Uncle Billy about the plan to house it at Tom's as well. He said about 1 week before his death, he talked to him about it, and Uncle Billy said that he told him that is a bad idea. He said a young black man in that house, if he's going to stay there, he needs to get a certified letter stating what he's doing just in case anybody comes and has any kind of problem with him. Now, he also said that Mike told him that he's going to be coming into money from Tom. He said that Tom is going to be hiring him as a driver because he has a bad back and he doesn't want to drive. He said that he's going to be starting a new life out of state and he's going to go visit his son. He said also with that money, he and Tom were planning on going to buy jet skis. But he said Mike wasn't a boatman. He had never known him to go jet skiing or talk about it at all before. They bring up the ski mask that Billy and Vita had told detectives 15 years ago that they were missing or that they hadn't seen since December. They brought out the one that they had in evidence and they show it to Billy. He asks if this is the one that he was missing from his house. Billy said no, because mine was open. It wasn't tied together like this one, and the mouth and nose area were more open. He said that Mike always wore a baseball hat, which was something that they asked him because of the baseball hat that was found by Mike's body in the garage. And he shows him the one that was in evidence, and he said that, yes, that is the one that Mike always wore. Now, on cross-examination, of course, they come up and ask him a lot of questions about everything he just said. They asked about the bike, and Billy said he doesn't really remember him using it that often. He does remember him using the car sometimes. They asked about him having a girlfriend toward the end of his life and if he would ever get rides from her. Billy said she would pick him up sometimes and drop him off. Defense also asked Uncle Billy if sometimes Mike wanted advances of money from Tom. He said, I don't know, because he actually complained that he never got paid when he did the work for Tom. They also brought up the gloves missing from the house, and he said that he doesn't remember talking about the gloves or that he had gloves missing from the house. He says, do you remember telling police department that you said that gloves were missing? And Uncle Billy said, show me. I don't remember that. Show me. They pulled the statement, and he said that there was a missing pair of black cotton gloves, and he said, well, if I had the gloves, then I wear them for work because I do janitorial work, but I can't say some were missing because I don't value things like that. He said basically he doesn't know, he doesn't remember, he doesn't think about it. It's been 15 years and it's just cheap cotton gloves. They also ask him about the ski mask and they show him the transcript of the interview from May 9th where he's asked about the ski mask. He describes it and he says in the statement that they hadn't used it recently because it wasn't cold. Now, they hadn't used it recently because it wasn't cold. Keep in mind, his wife had said that they haven't seen it since before Christmas because it wasn't cold. It drives me nuts, and I know they're doing their job and I'm trying to be understanding, but it drives me nuts when they twist that fact. Now, he asked him, can you describe the mouth? And he said that it stretched over the mouth and the nose if you chose. It was like one of those big openings. So he said it's also a high quality type that you can pull all the way down if you want to. And he's describing it. And he said that the one that they showed him, the one that they had in evidence, he said that it has the tied up part in it and it's different material. He said, that one is not mine. That's not the one that we had. He also said that he had talked to the homicide detectives about the talks at the mailbox. Defense asked if he had talked to the prosecutor. He said he talked to the homicide detectives. They brought up the red sweatshirt and the brown cowboy boots that came from Tom that Mike had on when he was found. He said that the last time that he saw him wearing that was 3 days before. He said that it was 3 days before he found out about Mike's death that they had seen him. He said that he was actually missing. They didn't know where he was. One of the things that I love that Nevada does and some other states do is that they let the jury ask questions. I love that. And this jury is on top of it. They've done a great job at asking questions. One of the things that they picked up on and one of the things that they asked Uncle Billy is about the gun that Mike had. He said that it was a small black handgun, maybe a 9mm. It was a semi-automatic, not a revolver. They also asked him, on May of 2008, when they found out that Mike was dead, was the bike missing from the garage? And he said, no, I don't think so. All right, so next we're going to get into the DNA stuff. Now, there are three different DNA scientists that come in and talk. I'm going to give you, there's so much technical stuff with DNA, y'all, and I'm not going to get into all of the technical stuff. I'm just going to give you the important parts of what we learned. Now, the first forensic scientist for DNA that came in is Jennifer Brown. She said that she examined the gloves that Tom had on. She swabbed them and she said on the left glove there were three spots of blood. All three of them were Mike's. They also found blood on Mike's hoodie, and all of the stains of blood belonged to Mike. They said that they tested the gun and there was no blood on the gun. Now, this is the 38. This is the gun that Mike supposed to have used to kill Sharon. The one shot that was fired out of it, and then the 38 was left over by Sharon's body. So this is that one that they're testing. She said that they also tested the plastic Walmart bags on the handles. Now, she said that the handles of the bags had a mixture of three people. Mike cannot be excluded, and Tom is a minor contributor, but not excluded. Mike was the major contributor. On the second bag, Mike was also major contributor, and Tom was a minor contributor. The ski mask was tested, and on the inside, there was a DNA mixture, and it was a match for Mike. Now, on cross-examination, they asked Jennifer Brown how many samples were done from the ski mask. She said that it was one, but it was the entire inside, and Tom was excluded from the inside of the ski mask. They asked, were you ever asked to take DNA from Billy Miller? Now, Billy Miller is, of course, the uncle that we just heard from. They didn't test his DNA, and I guess the questioning here is they're trying to say that the mask that Mike was wearing is the one that was missing from Billy's house. Now, they asked, did you see bullet holes on the sweatshirt? And she said no, she didn't notice those. They asked, would you expect a major profile on the mask? She said that that would depend on if only one person wore it. So with the mask, the question is, would you expect a major profile? So if there's only one person who had worn it, then yeah, there would be a major profile. If there's multiple people who have worn it at different times, then there's going to be a lot more contamination. So a little bit harder to tell. Now, they also asked, this is a jury question, why not do a touch DNA test on the 38 Special, on that gun? The reason is that they tested it for blood, and they could only test one without compromising it for the other test. Now, the second forensic scientist that came in to do DNA, her name is Allison Rubino, and she tested the Walmart bags with more technology. This is later on. Her testing came later on. But they weren't able to give any more information about that that gives any kind of additional clues to anything. The other thing that she did test was the knife handle. Remember that knife that we heard about that was sitting on the kitchen, like, butcher block cart thing? She said that the knife handle was tested, and they cannot exclude Sharon or Tom. So, no big shocker there. The third and final DNA analyst that came in is Kimberly Dannenberger. Now, Kimberly tested some hair and tissue that was found near Sharon's body, and it was a match for Sharon, and Tom and Mike were both excluded from that. She tested a swab of fatty tissue from the AC vent, likely that got up there when Sharon was shot, and Sharon was included in that profile. There was also a staining of the north hall that was tested, and it was actually presumptive negative for blood. There was also apparent tissue from the east hall, and that one was a match for Sharon. There was one swab from staining that they tested. It was the west wall above the bathroom door, but that one was negative, presumptive blood test. There was also a swab done in the north wall of the east and west hallway, and a swab on the west wall of the north and south hallway. I know this gets confusing, y'all. It was presumptive negative for blood, and they couldn't obtain DNA for it. Now, I know that this sounds like a lot of whatever. There's nothing really earth-shattering here. Basically, the blood and the DNA of the people who you would expect it to be where it should be was. It was just, this one was basically just the blood and tissue from where Sharon was shot. All right, so moving right along. Like I said, days 5 and 6 were both a little bit shorter. So we're going to get through them quickly. Day 6 was, again, a short day, but there was some really important information that came out. The first person on the stand is Dr. Lisa Gavin. She is the medical examiner. Now, there's a lot of technical talk here, and y'all know how I am with the technical talk. We are going to skip over all of the technical stuff and just give you the meat and potatoes of what you need to know. The first autopsy that we look at is Sharon Miller's. Now, the cause of death is gunshot wound to the head. Again, this is nothing surprising. The bullet went right to left, and it was pretty much straight through at close range. Her toxicology report was clean, no drugs or anything like that in her system. Mike Miller's autopsy was, of course, much more complicated than that. His tox screen showed that he had cocaine in his system. Based on the level of metabolization, it wasn't something that he had ingested like right before his death, but it was present. Mike's cause of death is multiple gunshot wounds, 5 to be exact. Now, the shots are numbered according to how the medical examiner lists them on the diagrams, normally like top to bottom. But just a note, the numbers do not represent the order that the shots were fired in. Okay, so wound number 1, it entered near Mike's left ear and exited through his right frontal scalp area. Now, because we don't know what direction he was looking in, we can't really tell much about the origin of this shot in relation to where he was just based on this. Wound number 2 entered into his left, well, right around, his left eyebrow, and it traveled down through his body. This one's kind of gross, y'all, but it goes down through his body. It actually detaches his tongue. It exits through the right anterior aspect of the neck, kind of near the clavicle. Now, this is like a steep pathway of this bullet, and the origin must have been coming from kind of like above the head, traveling through the body. So Mike would have had to have been either falling, slouching, laying, something like that. So this one isn't one of the shots that was fired while he was standing. I believe this one and the one that we just mentioned that entered in through his left ear and exited through the right frontal scalp area. Both of those may have been the ones that were fired after he was down. All right, wound number 3. It entered through the left upper quad of the abdomen, and then it traveled through the body, exiting the center of the chest. Entering the abdomen and exiting the chest puts the point of origin of this shot, also coming from a position where Mike had to have been already like falling or laying down. Wound number four. This is the only one of the five that did not have an exit wound. And remember, number four doesn't mean it was the fourth time he was hit. It's just the number that they're ordered in. So the bullet was recovered from inside of his body. The entrance wound was the left lateral chest, and it traveled left to right across the body through the stomach area and into the muscles of his back. Wound number five entered into his left elbow and exited the left forearm. The origin of this one's also really hard to determine because we don't know his arm position or anything like that at the time that this shot was fired. Now, this is interesting because the way that Tom described everything happening was all that nonsense that he was talking about in the, you know, hallway where he was bam, 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 and all that stuff he was saying. So all of these being in the left side of Mike's body pretty much go directly against everything he said. Shocker. Tom lied. So surprised. Something else that's not a surprise is that I'm not happy with how this cross-examination went. It is no secret that I have not been a fan of the defendant, especially, or the defense strategy, and this is no exception. We've talked before about Sharon's tattoos. Now, during the autopsy, the medical examiner makes note of the tattoos on the body, and the defense insisted on having her list them on record for all of the world to hear. Prosecution objected to relevance, but after a sidebar, the objection was overruled, and Josh had the medical examiner list them for the court. She had a design on her right forearm near her wrist. She had a red heart with a black design on the central area of her right leg and a scorpion with a stinger on her lateral left leg. Now, on her upper left arm, she had a sunburst, and below that sunburst, she had the names of Colleen, her daughter, and Nicholas, her grandson. The last tattoo, the one that either Tom or his defense insisted on bringing up constantly, is a heart with the initials TR that she has on her labia majora. If you don't know where that is, don't Google it. But just know that Sharon had the names of her beloved daughter and grandson on her arm for the whole world to see, along with a sunburst. And she had Tommy Boy's initials in a totally different location where the sun don't shine. Now, I get frustrated hearing them harp on this stupid tattoo because having his initials tattooed on her did not keep him from having an affair. It didn't keep her from crying to her friends that she was unhappy and needed a divorce, and it didn't make them have a happy marriage. So why do they think that those initials on her body will make the jury think any better of Tom? It won't work. But it's one more way that he can victimize her and those who love her here, even 15 years after she's gone. The other witness from day six is bloodstain pattern analyst Randy McPhail. Randy has extensive experience and went to the crime scene to take pictures. He made notes and labeled anything like blood or oily substance, anything like that. He noticed where evidence was and he collected it, then recreated the crime scene to figure out what happened based on everything he found. Now, rather than go little bitty piece by little bitty piece and spend all the time going over what he found and how he documented it, that's kind of like handing you one puzzle piece at a time. So I'll just give you his conclusions. He found that when Sharon was shot, she was shot right where her knees were, basically, and it was right near the bathroom door. He said that she believes she was heading toward the master bedroom because the wound on her was on her right side and the debris came out and hit those walls. And based on the recreation, it looked like she was heading toward the master bedroom. He said the shooter would have been near the bathroom door also. There was a near contact wound to her head, which means he was like right up on her. So he was either at the bathroom door, maybe possibly slightly inside the bathroom. Now, while McPhail was there, that's also when they found those fired 9mm cartridge cases in the garage. Okay, I'll see if I can kind of describe the location of this. It's the southwest corner of the garage, and in the corner, there's like a water heater. Then right beside that on the wall is the door that enters into the house. On the other side of the door is a refrigerator. So the doorway is kind of in between this water heater that's in the corner and the refrigerator. The cases were found right in that area. There's a toolbox and there's a blue tray that has tools in it. And one of the cases was found in that tray. And the other one was kind of positioned on the ground behind the area where the water heater is. There's like a water jug back there for water softener, and the casing was in the very back of that area, which is how it got missed the first time. Now, defense doesn't really have a lot to work with here. Of course, they haven't had a lot to work with on a lot of this trial, but basically all Josh can do is try to poke holes in anything he can. So he points out the fact that these pictures were taken about a week after the murders happened. He points out things that had been moved from the first round of pictures to this round of pictures. He shows pictures where there was blood before and now the blood is gone. He's basically saying that the pictures that he's taking of evidence aren't really as accurate as they could be because things had happened in the house and there had been cleaning, basically trying to just poke holes. But like I said, there's really not a whole lot that they have to work with here. Another thing he does here is try to talk about the possibility that the cartridge cases that were found over by the water heater could have been kicked or moved. They really, really don't want the jury to think that all of the cartridge cases that were found in the garage originated from that area because of Tom saying with such force in so many interviews that he started shooting Mike when he was in the hallway.
Me that because the area in which you impounded them from had moved in the last week, the cartridge case had presumably moved too.
It's possible. It's certainly possible.
Okay. You'd agree with me that a week later, after items have moved and been cleaned up, it has a lot less evidentiary value to you, doesn't it?
It's a lot more difficult to tell a story if something's been moved, yes.
Right. In other words, if you're looking at forensic evidence in order to prove or disprove a story, if it's been altered, it makes it a lot harder, right?
Yes.
In fact, it's practically impossible, isn't it?
It can be.
Josh also points out that when McPhail went to actually do the photography and look for anything of evidentiary value, it was a week after, but it was also the same night that they did the walkthrough that they recorded with the police department. So he shows screenshots from this walkthrough, and he's saying that, look, everything is clean and things of evidentiary value had been removed. And even though we know that they had already gone through and done one big sweep of everything and photographed everything, we know that this is a secondary one. But Josh is trying to point out that if things were cleaned, you don't know how much of what you photographed or how much of what you found is actually accurate or depicts any kind of information that you can gather from it. During redirect, the prosecutor asks if it's common to go to crime scenes where you can't find all of the shell cases or if they are not able to locate a specific piece of evidence that they know exists. He says yes, and that's something that, you know, in all of his years of doing this, that's something that keeps him up at night, not being able to find something or being worried that he missed something. He says there's no perfect crime scene, but it's their job to just do as thorough of a job as they can. All right, day 7, y'all. We are moving right along. All right, so Tony Maldano is a retired police sergeant at the Metro Police Department, and he is first up on the stand on day 7. He said he arrived at the scene on the night of May 8th, and the garage door was closed, so they entered through the front. He recounts kind of what happened that night. He said that Officer Mitchell was the first to enter and saw Sharon's body, so they needed to clear the home. He said that he heard the homeowner's wife had been shot by an intruder, and then the homeowner shot an intruder, but that's really the only information that he had going into everything. He said they didn't know where the suspect was. They saw Sharon's body, and he said he decided to call for SWAT to come clear the home. He said he doesn't think that SWAT ever actually came out, though, because he decided that they didn't need to wait, or actually the lieutenant decided that they didn't need to wait on SWAT. They could clear the house themselves. So they use this witness on the stand as a way to go over the CAD report. So it's basically the report of what time, what happened, and who reported where and with what unit. So they go over the paramedics and what time they got there, and the canine units and what time they got there, and things like that. I'm not going to get in too much to this right now because I know that our next testimony that we have is going to be the head detective, Dean O'Kelly. So his detail recollection of this is going to be a lot more involved. So I'm not skipping it, but just know that it is coming. Also, there are multiple things that he couldn't quite remember. Like I said, this has been 15 years, y'all. So Detective Dean O'Kelly, though, he was the lead detective, and y'all, he has this memorized like the back of his hand. During cross-examination, they ask him about what time he arrives, and he said that the dispatcher said he arrived at 8:58. Now, he uses this time to explain kind of how that works. He said that they get the info about what time the officers arrived through the officer either announcing it, like on the radio, or hitting the arrive button. Sometimes they can also get it, like if another officer on the scene says that they see that officer or whatever. But he said that normally it's by either hitting that button or announcing that they've arrived. He also talks about how the CAD works with info coming in and the timestamps. The 911 operator actually chooses what to put in the CAD report. So remember when the prosecutor asked about the garage door being opened or being closed, and the officer or sergeant said, yes, it was closed. So they talk a little bit about that. Josh asked the sergeant if he knows on the 911 call when they told him that he can go open the door, do you know what door that was referring to? And he doesn't know. He says probably the garage. Then Josh asks, does it say on the CAD report that 911 tells him don't go open the garage door? And he says no. He then goes over the list and he talks about how many people showed up and entered the house, asking Sergeant Maldonado if he knows about how many people total went in the house, and asked if the canine units went in and if they had any kind of special training in preserving a crime scene. Talking about the dogs. Now, remember the conversation that has been had about how Tom seems kind of like he's not really tending to Sharon, and when they're telling him to give compressions, he's basically like, oh, I need to go do this and this, and I need to go look for the gun, and maybe I should go open this door, and he's kind of distracted. Well, Josh points out that in the CAD report, there is a line that says that the person is asking for advice on how to treat his wife. Now, having that in the report and us hearing what happened are two very different things, but he wanted to point it out to the jury. Redirect here does a great job, though, because on the 911 call, when they tell him to go open the door, they say go open the front door. So even though Josh said, what door would you assume that he went to go open? And he said, I don't know, probably the garage. That's not what they said. So they did do a great job of pointing that out here. They also pointed out that the CAD report read where Tom told 911 that he knew Mike because Mike had been scanning him. And then they pointed out where he actually told 911 that he locked the garage door and said that if the door was locked, responders could not have kicked shell casings through that door, could they? You can't kick a shell casing through a closed and locked door, right? Also, since the door to the garage was locked, the canine unit would only have been walking into the garage, not the house. So they used that little piece of information to kind of debunk the whole dogs walking through the house thing, too. Now, I'm going to play y'all a clip, and this is not one of those clips that gives you evidentiary information, or it's not a aha gotcha moment, but the sass in this is worth sharing because the prosecutor and the defense attorney during the questioning, going back and forth on here, they both got their sassy pants on, and it was really funny to watch. The words they use are definitely for dramatic effect. So instead of saying, hey, these people may have walked through the crime scene and done some kind of damage to any of the evidentiary value, or may have kicked the shell cases or anything like that, that's not what they say. The defense uses words like they trampled through there, and not to be outdone with the dramatics, the prosecutor gets up and says, oh, so they just waltz right through there. Well, defense attorney Josh didn't like him using the word waltz right through there, so he questioned the witness about this just as a way to show his snarkiness. It had nothing to do with the witness, y'all. This was all just them being attorneys.
Do you have any reason to believe that even after you left the scene, that your fellow detectives would then let just countless people waltz through the scene?
Do you have any reason to believe that
detectives who were there and the officers were there would just let an inordinate amount of people go waltzing through the scene after you left?
No, that.
Of course, Joshy couldn't let it go, so he had to question the witness on this when he got back up.
Yes. You ever seen anybody waltz in a crime scene?
Yes.
Waltz?
Well, depending on the crime scene, yes. Okay. I mean, I don't know what you mean by waltz.
You asked the question a bunch of times about whether or not anyone was waltzing through the crime scene. Like, a waltz is a dance, right?
It could be, yes.
Yeah. You've seen somebody dance in a crime scene?
No.
What's even funnier about this is that poor Sergeant Maldonado is just there to do his job, and he has been so fantastic and professional, and he doesn't even understand that these attorneys are just going at each other like they have been the whole time. That wraps it up for this episode. The next witness that comes up is Detective Dean O'Kelly, and his testimony stretches out over the course of a couple days, so I want to start the next episode with his, and he has a lot to say. Now, Detective Dean O'Kelly, he's been working on this, y'all, for 15 years. He's already been through the trial. He has gone all over the country investigating this. He is the one who was able to discover all of the past and the previous trial and the previous witnesses and witnesses that they hadn't even talked to before, basically revealing the patterns of Thomas Randolph all over the country. He has a lot of good stuff to say, and he does a fantastic job on the stand. He stayed calm, he was very matter-of-fact, and even when the defense tried to get to him, he kept his cool, and he gave some really, really great information and great answers. So I don't want to cut his short. I want to make sure that we take our time on that one. And he's the last scene for the state. So that's going to be on the next episode, so make sure you tune in. I appreciate y'all listening. Please like, share, subscribe, do all that good stuff, and leave us a review. It really helps us out. I am real excited to see what happens next. I will see y'all on the next episode. My name is Brandy Churchwell. Thanks for reporting to jury duty.
Yeah.